Hello and welcome to another episode of the Atlas Podcast. My name's Alex. I'm joined as always by Martin. Hello, Martin.
Hello, Alex. I apologise, really. We're a bit a week later than we normally are, but things happen, don't they? So we're back on it, aren't we, Alex?
We are. Nice things happen. We both had a week off. We just had opposite weeks off, yeah. So it's good to be back. We actually recorded our interview before we left for our break, so this has been a bit of a wait coming, but it's a really great interview, which we'll introduce in a mo. On this week's episode, our sort of newsy section, as often happens, it's not something that came up this week, but it was an interview you spotted from a few months ago around the scientific method and really updates on COVID-19, which is still in the news cycle. We'll be talking about that in a moment. We've got our tech spot. Previous episode, we introduced the Gartner report, the 2022 top strategic technology trends for 2022. And it's split into a few different sections. So this time we're going to be talking about engineering trust, and that's going to lead on to a little discussion on, some cloud native ideas, cloud native platforms and XaaS. And then finally, as mentioned, we get into our interview with Brett King, who's a really interesting guy. The circumstances of the interview were fun because he was in a holiday home in North Carolina. You were recording from an airport car park on your way to a leadership meeting. And I was the only one who managed to find a desk. But it's a great interview. And we look forward to introducing that later.
Excellent. Yeah, really great episode. I'm looking forward to it, Alex.
100%. Yeah. So if you want to give a bit of an introduction to the topic of this interview you found, it's actually in a podcast you can listen to on BBC Sounds, which we'll link to. Take it away.
So I guess it was one of those things you're thinking, oh, winter's arriving in the Northern Hemisphere. You're starting to hear about the rise of COVID. As you said, it's rumbling along in the background in the news cycle, but other things are more predominant there. And occasionally something comes up, you think, oh, I wonder what's going on in that particular sphere. And I have an inherent interest because my wife is a doctor and her friends were part of the COVID response when they set up dedicated hospitals here in Exeter, the Nightingale Hospital. So they were there from the start of when the Nightingale Hospitals were set up and they were working inside those facilities. And they were
front lines, as it were,
so they were part of what do you do on day one when you don't have any treatments? And this podcast really led through from that perspective of we don't know what we're doing. We've got this new virus. Well, not a new virus, because I know we knew of COVID type viruses before, but this new strain of the COVID SARS virus. And it was having such a devastating effect, but you don't have any treatments or you don't know what those treatments are. So this podcast actually was interviewing the guy who basically ran the trial, which they called Recovery, to be able to take an evidence-based approach, deploying the scientific process to find out what is the best treatment. It's called the Recovery Trial, and it's actually their own, obviously they're in a position to have the power and authority to put this program underway, but it was their own initiative. They thought, here, this stuff's happening in Italy. We've got to do something about this. Let's go and drive this forward ourselves. And they set up this thing called the Recovery Trial based on a whole load of
history. Just put a name on there as well. Sorry to interrupt. It's Sir Martin Landry. I just got the name. Yeah.
Sorry. That's all good. That's the really important. So Martin's got a big history of looking at evidence-based. He was involved with some of other evidence-based approaches previously, and also discounting some things that people thought were drugs, especially in his area of cardiology. But anyway, so for to summarize, evidence-based approaches are generally kind of blind trials of which you use a coin toss to decide on a particular approach that you're going to take. So trying to remove biases out of the system. So they took this very basic approach. So they took, when we talked about the digital transformation approach previously, so they understood the processes that they wanted to use in the recovery trial. So they put some criteria around those processes. And one of those things was they wanted to have a structured organization, which luckily in the UK we have the NHS, which is allows for a level of structured control. And they wanted to make sure that the people that are going to interact with the trial affected their work with minimal interference. Because they knew that the doctors and nurses were very busy, but they wanted to collect this evidence from there to be able to run their trial. So they were very much looking at that kind of things that we were talking about in the digital transformation, and they wanted a very simple technology that focused on very simple criteria. So they went back to collecting their data very simply through a web front end, because they wanted to be able to have scale where they could get enough results so they could have an obvious outcome.
That's interesting. It's something I hadn't realized before. It's just, you know, you make assumptions. They want to do as many people as possible because actually there's very few wonder drugs out there, as he put it. There's a couple of things that do. He gave examples of, I think, penicillin and meningitis, things like that, that are real silver bullets. But in general, medicine it's by degrees.
Yes.
So if you have 10 people in a trial, you might see some results somewhere, but it won't give you nearly enough data to prove out your hypothesis.
So your effect size depends on the sensitivity of the results you can achieve, basically. Yeah, absolutely. So he understood the scale of what he needed to do. But he needed to be simple and effective to be able to achieve it. And there's also then the whole political aspect of it. So which of the four drugs do you choose to do the test upon? And you could imagine being put in that position with all of that political weight of presidents and experts feeding their opinion into what they think are those four drugs that they should choose. And you know, it's not just those who are uneducated that had an opinion. The experts in their field thought this will be the drug that works. And yet, without there being an evidence-based approach for it, it is just opinion. And it could be from experts or it could be from those who are trying to run our political establishments. So
there were a lot put forwards as well. That was the other thing I learned. It's not just a guess. It makes sense. Antiviral drugs and things like that were put forward initially as really good options. And I as a layman can understand why. But actually, when you test them, no effect whatsoever. Did nothing, basically. Yeah.
And even some of them can have negative effects. So that's the thing where people say, why do you have a placebo, which is the baseline where nobody gets the drug or they get a sugar tablet or something like this, sugar pill. That's because some of the drugs might have an adverse effect.
Yeah.
So actually, no treatment can be better than some treatment. So there's all those kind of things. So obviously, they run this situation. Like I said, my friends were working in the hospital at the time, didn't know what treatments were the best treatments. This trial was running, and after the trial ended, there, as the podcast goes on to, there was a clear result of what was the best drug. Which is, once again, you don't know if there's going to be a clear result, but all four of them might have been
duds.
And this is for drugs for treating people with COVID, you know, people in intensive care and things like this. This isn't the vaccine side of the world. This is, you know, it took a year or so to develop the vaccine. This is what do we do with people in hospital now? And what drugs are we available on the shelf?
People on ventilators, people being given oxygen. How do you minimize, the adverse effects and, in the end, mortality as well?
Absolutely. So, you know, to me, this is everything that I love about science and community and those people that go out and want to make a difference. And So what difference did it make? Well, after analysing the data for 9 days, because they knew if they got it wrong, not only the patients would suffer, but the political ramifications, it would be huge. Because the drugs that the experts thought and the drugs that the presidents were promoting weren't the drugs that the results showed were the successful one. The successful one was the cheap, readily available drug. So the perfect result occurred, but not necessarily what everybody else wanted. And the thing that really struck me, and you said this before we started recording, Alex, was when do you go to work and experience such a clear outcome? You know, so you find out what the result is. There's a bit of anticipation there.
Yeah.
You've got to go and then
it's not only not only accepted, but as you said, it's put into action. I think they released the findings after the 9 days of double checking, triple checking, whatever, at lunchtime, and by tea time, it was instigated not just all over the country but all over the world. I think the statistic was he thinks, looking back on it, they probably saved about 1 million lives, and that's really what I think. My best day at work, I rarely save a single life. So 1 million lives is pretty impressive.
So amazing, amazing things. Yeah, it's just like, and that's by just doing the scientific process of what you know and the implications of it and the impacts of it were absolutely huge. And we're living, so we, like I said, we're coming into the winter of 2022. With vaccines now that are actually the impact of the vaccine is causing the virus to actually kind of reduce, not reduce in its space, but the mutations of it they're becoming more specialized again, which is a strange impact of the pressures of the vaccines having on the virus itself and the way the virus mutates. We've got well-known treatments about how we can go forward. That level has brought it under to an acceptable level, but it's still there. There's still deaths, but it's without that, we would be in a completely different position. So,
as you mentioned, well done, science. Round of applause for science. I think as you mentioned previously as well, all of this goes into the latest COVID statistics, that we did have another rise in cases, as you would expect. Same with flu, same with everything coming into the winter period. But it looks like the peak has already been reached and it's dropping off. So all of these things combine to a much brighter outlook for sure.
Absolutely. And I had my fourth vaccine.
Very nice. I haven't had mine yet, but it's on the cards.
I'm just a little bit older than you, Alex.
Just a smidge.
Brilliant stuff. So, really, we got a couple of... So, link to that podcast, which has got a lot about the human behind the...
Yeah, it's great. It's 40 minutes long, and it's a lovely just chat between two people, which is... It's what we try and do, so we enjoy listening to it too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Alrighty, so moving on to from science and tech and med to more pure technology. We mentioned before the break that we were looking at this Gartner Top Strategic Technology Trends report, which is nicely divided into a few overarching sections. And today we're going to have a look at the engineering trust bit of it, which is talking about how talking about trends that are coming up now and in the very near future that are about engineering trust. So different technologies that go into making people, making clients, making companies more trustworthy, or more trustworthy, but in engendering trust in.
Exactly, and resilient and efficient, because they're almost like your foundations, aren't they? Without your foundations, you're not going to trust living in a house. So you've got to have a level of foundation to it. And And we were reviewing the four things they talked about. So they've got data fabric, cybersecurity mesh, privacy enhancement computing, and the actual platform itself, the cloud native platform. So if we look to that as trust, do you trust the data? Do you trust the security? And also how privacy is done within that security, and then the fundamentals of the infrastructure to be able to deliver whatever you're going to build upon that later. So they're the four things that it talks about, really.
Just
a good foundation for trust, I think, probably.
Yeah. 100%. I think one of the things that jumped out to me whilst I was reviewing this is that it's about, as often happens, not looking at what these new emergent technologies, the issues they cause, but leaning into what they can provide. So thinking about the security and the data fabric, especially, I think what a lot of people worry about is with cloud, things are all over the place. And certainly from a security perspective, you think, well, if everything's being stored in cloud servers all around the world, then you only need to sort of hack one bit of that and then you have more broad access. But actually, if you lean into the decentralized nature of it, then you have opportunities for security that you wouldn't have with a single monolithic entity. Same with the data mesh as well, or the data fabric is, it feels disorganized, but actually making use of the fact that everything is in its own separate area gives you more power to do complex and intricate things with that data.
Yeah, and I think there's lots of words thrown around with data. You know, there's data lakes and all of these types of things, data warehouses and things like this. But really, the world of IT has been dominated by application-centric architectures in a three-tier architecture, of which the data and the business logic and the user front end are the three tiers. But the data has predominantly been there for the application, not for the business.
Yeah.
So that's the world that we've lived in for quite a while. So that means that we end up with siloed data applications, and even the terminologies can be very different. So what's a material in one system or a material ID in one system might be called a completely different thing. It might be called a part, or it might.
Yeah.
And therefore, the lexicon of what they have been dominated by what the applications want them to be called. And not how the business operates. So that remains to be the challenge, really. When that's why they kind of use the word data fabric, because you, as you pointed, it could be centralized data lakes. It could be business data models, of which outside of an application architecture. But as we spent the last 30 years building up an application architecture, the likelihood is we're going to have some kind of level of hybrid scenario. So the more and more you're seeing, well, the more we're seeing it, we're seeing businesses moving, especially cloud and scale, moving into more of the technologies that allow for there to be centralized data because of the internet technologies that have created new databases that allow for huge amounts of data to be stored in different ways. So originally, but you know, SQL databases for the last 20 years, 30 years have been the dominant database for applications.
Yeah.
Now we have time series databases, we have document databases, we have mesh relationship databases. So there's a whole load of different
relationship database. Yeah.
So, you know, so it changes the way it is. So they're really focusing on, yes, businesses need to take control of their data fabric, basically, and understand what their data models are, and then understand how they can move potentially from a data-centric world to more of a an efficient way of utilizing that data through the ways of using more optimizing those new technologies. And one interesting one there is there's the example we gave with the COVID, you know, very simple, they very targeted data, they needed it for that moment. And it all comes around to what is the problem you're trying to solve and how do you access that data in a controlled way to be able to solve that problem. And therefore, yeah. I think data will become far more not about collecting all the data and then being able to analyze it. You'll actually be turning on its head and go, what is the problem I'm trying to solve? Let's collect that data, analyze it, and then you might not use that particular data set going forward.
Yeah. I thought, there was an interesting bit around the data fabric that it almost feels recursive, that actually you're using data to figure out what data you don't need so that you can have the smallest amount of data possible. It's using data to cut down on data. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
We otherwise, we've become hoarders.
Yes, data hoarders. Nobody wants that.
Excellent.
But yeah, at the end there, we had cloud native platforms. And as you briefly mentioned there, obviously, we are developing. We do develop and produce a cloud native platform. And we're big believers in cloud native platform over, as is mentioned in the report, lift and shift migrations. Maybe it's worth just giving a brief explanation of what lift and shift is, and then we can get into why.
So we talked about the application centric world of architectures previously, and then they've generally been either originally on installed onto computers or servers, and then the concept of virtual machines come around, where then you could install your application onto a virtual machine and you could move your virtual machine around on servers. And then we end up with cloud, which is a kind of iteration of that, which is breaks it down into these microservices and micro apps. Well, the problem there is you can't easily lift and shift a monolithic application into a microservice architecture. So what they talk about lift and shift is predominantly lifting that machine and putting it in a VM in the cloud or some kind of virtualized platform in the cloud, which doesn't take, as the report says, does not take the full advantages of the cloud.
So you're doing you're essentially doing the same thing in a different way. So
And what this report talks about, which I'm obviously very happy about, it talks about cloud native and it talks about microservice architectures, which we do. And it talks here, which was a statistic that I don't know what's behind it, but I find quite amazing. By 2025, cloud native platforms will serve as a foundation for more than 95% of new digital initiatives, up from 40% in 2021.
Yeah.
That to me is a huge step change in the thinking of industry from where we are.
Yeah.
I don't know where we were when we started in 2018, what percentage was doing it, but makes us an early adopter, Alex. That's all I know.
Absolutely. Front and center on our headlines. Yeah. But yeah, no, that is, and I presume because they're taking the data from 2021, they must just be looking at the line on the graph, because that's a massive increase, obviously, 40% up to 95%. And I know it's a prediction, who can say whether we actually hit that, but Gartner are usually pretty bang on with these forecasts. So yeah, almost entirely cloud native from 2025. I know that's new ventures. So obviously some legacy will remain.
Absolutely. And there are reports that say, especially if you're moving from a lift and shift to a replatforming, which is this going from what you have today into a microservice architecture. There's another group of analysts called the TSIA who predict because they've analyzed the market, will take between 4 and 9 years to achieve. So it's not a small investment required when people consider these things. And when you consider 30 years of software being developed in an application-centric world to shifting all of that, not lifting and shifting it, replatforming it into a microservice architecture, we got a long way to go.
Perhaps it's that old quote, it's not the beginning of the end, it's the end of the beginning, really.
Yeah,
yeah, there's work to do.
application-centric architectures will be around for a long time yet. I'd imagine they'll be here still for the next 10 years at some level. But so there is a delay. There's a lag in the system. So if 95% of those initiatives are starting by 2025 and it takes 7 to 8 years to replatform them, you know, we're into 2033 before potentially there won't be any application-centric architectures out there. But who knows?
Yes, but I think you also you wanted to shift on and have a quick look at, because that led us onto a discussion about something we talk about often, which is SaaS, PaaS, IaaS. Never sure how to pronounce that one. Yes. But yeah, all of the all of the XaaS models.
There's PaaS as well for functions. Yeah.
So anything as a service, basically. We got, yeah, what we traditionally talk about is our application as software as a service, platform as a service, infrastructure as a service. And yeah, it's raised questions in our minds, because are we a SaaS or are we a PaaS? And this is really the discussion we were having.
Yeah, and it's not clear, to be quite honest. And I do wonder, you know, we've got this, you have this traditional network, traditional IT architecture stack, networking, storage, server hardware, virtualization, which we already kind of talked about, servers, databases, security and integration, runtime and applications built on top of it. And now some people put this functions, which is the microservice apps that we're talking about, in there as well. That whole IT stack, in the traditional sense, means that some of that is owned by the end user. Traditionally, it's all owned by the end user. And then in the infrastructure as a service, the networking, storage, hardware, and the virtualization is managed by someone else, and then you put your servers, databases, security, applications on top of it. A PaaS, you do all of that apart from the applications.
Yeah.
So it's all been about who owns what, and then a SaaS is completely provided by someone else, and you rent the complete technology stack of it.
Yeah.
What gets confusing is the terminology used with it, because if you say you're a SaaS application, that's assuming you're delivering all these applications, which you are, but you're also delivering some SaaS capability and some IIS capability as well. Yeah, so is the rolling up of all of that means that you're a SaaS business, but some SaaS don't deliver multi-tenant environments or payment gateways or other things that you could be described are a part of the platform as a service. Then you get even more complicated world is that if you talk about rapid development applications, often called low code, but I don't like, once again, don't like, then they aren't a part of that technology stack. They are a way of generating that technology stack. So they're both a PaaS and a SaaS, because the PaaS bit of it's generating the SaaS, and it gets really quite complicated. So the long and short of it to me is that we shouldn't get too hung up on these terminologies, because as soon as we give those definitions, we can easily throw stones at whether it's SaaS or PaaS and things like that. But what it comes down to really is, to me, all about outcomes and use cases. What are the outcomes we're looking to achieve with this technology, and what are the use cases that can be provided by them? If we get too hung up on those terminologies, what is SaaS, PaaS, this and the other, we're really missing the point of what this elastic computing capability can do, and how ultimately, if you generate one application that is scalable and maintainable and usable, all those types of things that these types of technology can give, then everybody benefits, because we get a level of the scales of economy come into the equation, which means that we can drive down the cost of delivering IT ultimately, and provide better service for our customers. So it's a hard subject once we start chiseling down on the meanings and definitions of things. We have to remember why we like the cloud is because it allows us to capture our intellectual property in a managed way, and make it scalable through to our customers in an easy, maintainable package.
Exactly, yeah. And you're right, it is difficult. I mean, technology is, and talking about technology so often comes down to the definition of things, but especially in these sort of emergent worlds that have, yeah, last decade or so really come to the forefront, it's the lines are blurred between one and the other.
Yeah.
And every time I read one of these articles, I'm like, do I need to go back? Because I've written articles about these. Do I need to go back and add some question marks to things? This is what it is, question mark, you know?
Yeah.
But you're right. It's almost a fool's errand to go down on trying to pin them down rather than just discussing what you can achieve through the use of technology, which is much more what people want to know, actually, especially on the customer side of things.
Yep.
Wonderful. All right. I think it's time we jump over to our interview. I'll do an introduction on the other side. But yeah, it's Brett King. Really looking forward to it. And I hope you are too. And so for this interview portion of the Atlas podcast, we're joined by Brett King, futurist, entrepreneur, speaker, author of several books, including 2021's The Rise of Techno-Socialism, also a fellow podcaster, host of The Futurist and Breaking Banks. Welcome to the podcast, Brett.
Thanks very much for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Excellent. Yeah. So if you wouldn't mind giving us a bit of your background, how you got into the world of tech and really talking about the world of tech at large, I think we can start from there.
Sure. Well, I started as a programmer, actually. That was my primary career back in the day. This was a while ago, but I started on a platform, a very early relational database platform called PIC, working on BASIC. Moved to Visual Basic, Clipper, DBase, C++, et cetera, Java, in later years. But the thing that I found fairly early in my career is that I had a fairly unique ability to translate between technologists and business people, both ways. Mm-hmm. In respect to systems design and design needs, functionality, that sort of stuff, and that became sort of really the primary focus of the career. I had my own software business for a number of years, operating out of Australia, but working globally. And then bought an ISP in the mid-90s. That led me down the e-business route. I ended up heading up e-business for Deloitte in the region, based in Hong Kong in 99. Then went to a digital ad agency, Motive Media, one of the first digital ad agencies. From there, started a company in Dubai, moved to Dubai for a few years when the financial crisis hit. Took a year off and wrote my first book, Bank 2.0, on digital transformation of the banking industry. That ended up being a bestseller that enabled me to move to the US, where I was the resident futurist for another digital agency, Sapient Nitro, and at the same time started Movin, which was the world's first mobile challenger bank. A couple of years later started the Breaking Banks podcast, and since then I've written another six books, Bank 2, Bank 3, Bank 4, Brave Stay Gone Tomorrow, Breaking Banks, Augmented in 2015, which is probably my most celebrated book to date, given that it ended up on the bookshelf of President Xi in 2018 during his national address, and then Rise of Techno-Socialism.
Fantastic.
Alex.
That's the short version.
I was going to say, we've had some people on the podcast before, Alex, but wow, that was a very concise history, but covered a lot of ground in a few words. And I always like to dive into, Brett, I like to dive into people's past a little bit. You talked about being a programmer and this, even talking about programming in BASIC and things like this. This is
What was it about programming that you really liked, and what was it about programming that made you move on? Was there a natural progression from where it was? Was there some limitations in it, or it just you just evolved in that direction towards more the business side?
Well, I love the tech. You know, I taught myself to code at the age of 13. I bought myself a VIC-20 microcomputer back in the day, and taught myself to code. And the way I did that was essentially taking, you know, you'd get all these magazines from the, you know, from the local, you know, drugstore / news agents, we call them in Australia. And, you know, they would have a game in the book, and it would be 7 or 8 or, you know, 15 pages of code, and you'd have to type it in, you know, word for word, you know, to be able to play the game. And of course, that was how you, you really, learned back in those days. And then of course you'd type the code in, it wouldn't work. So you'd have to debug it. You know, that's how you learn. So, those early days, I was quite passionate about, the possibilities of coding, what coding could do for the world. And, you know, I saw, the potential for computing. Computing was still fairly new. You know, this is, you know, when I was 13, that's 81, you know, so, computing was having an impact, but, the transformational nature of computers wasn't understood by a lot of people, but I certainly, you know, I was interested in sci-fi and all of those things at a very early age, and I understood the transformational aspect of technology probably better than most. And a lot of people didn't understand when I was a kid, you know, why I was so interested in computers. But I think it, for me, it was linked to hope for a better future. But at some point, I realized that my ability as an individual to code the world and to change the world was fairly limited, and I needed to expand my horizons. And so then it became systemic thinking, you know, designing of systems, and, you know, much, and then, you know, sort of trend analysis and strategic consulting in the area, leading towards, you know, sort of the role as a futurist and, you know, taking industries and people on a journey to that potential future and dealing with some of the problems of transformation itself.
Yeah. And looking towards... looking towards the future, your latest novel has quite an impressive subtitle, How Inequality, AI and Climate Will Usher in a New World. Could you explain in your words what techno-socialism is and how it relates to that?
Yeah, well, there are, you know, we map out 4 possible world scenarios in sort of the cone of probability for humans' future. And, you know, the biggest problems we have to deal with over the next 30 years or so are all related to economic uncertainty. Economic uncertainty produced by climate change, produced by inequality, and of course produced by the introduction of artificial intelligence. And, you know, the pandemic we can throw in there as well. And that economic uncertainty can't be solved by the existing tool set we have. So if you look at where, how this plays out, there are sort of 4 scenarios. Our argument in the book is that, this, new form of collective thinking, which we call techno-socialism, which is, you know, it's not classic socialism in any means, but what it means is that the purpose of the economy is realigned towards the needs of citizens. And then corporations, you know, come in corporations and markets are secondary to the needs of citizens. So it's that the citizens own the means of the production of the economy, you know, like it taking the Marxist sort of theory a bit further. At the same time, it's a form of socialism that's far more efficient than the existing systems of capitalism we have today and would result in far better resource allocation and much better sustainability, you know, on the planet and so forth because of the organizing principles behind it. So that's what we call the optimal outcome for humanity. where we use technology for the good of all humans to improve the quality of life, longevity, all of those sorts of things. The three other scenarios are one where, we fail, because we just waited too long to respond to these challenges. So we call this the fail to stand scenario. So this is where you have large systemic collapse across the planet. Largely produced by climate change, but also because of other issues, food scarcity and things like that that we cover. The other one is rejection of technology more broadly, the ladder stand scenario. So rejection of artificial intelligence because it's taking humans out of the workforce. Those two scenarios are fairly, they're lower probability, but they will occur in some markets. Because of various responses, but probably the most likely scenario, unfortunately, is what we call neo-feudalism, where you have this permanent stratification between the rich and the poor, because that as the world increasingly is automated and as climate change hits and so forth, you have one set of rules for the wealthy elite that own the capital asset structure globally, and another set of rules for those that don't, particularly people that end up on universal basic income and so forth because of high levels of automation in society. So you get this sort of permanent stratification between the rich and the poor, more like the systems that we're familiar historically from the Middle Ages and so forth, with that really harsh inequality. So we argue that's a suboptimal outcome for the species, and so we do argue that we have to make some philosophical decisions that our current system of capitalism will produce that type of stratification of society unless we reform it.
And do you touch on the enablers for this world that you talk about, this future world of technology? Is there particular things that need to change? I'm thinking really of the data structures that we have today. A lot of the talk around AI is that the data is not very good, it's not in the right formats. And some things like in the financial industry, with things like open banking standards, are trying to address some of those issues.
Yeah, that's a good point. We do to some extent. I think it's more, we talk about systems design on a macro scale. So if you look at the systems design of economies, you look at the systems design of cities and the way we manage those, the epiphany of supermassive data sets and the combination of artificial intelligence is that actually, data is going to be the lifeblood of your ability to solve problems in terms of designing these, large scale, highly automated systems. We do sort of tackle this from, we actually take the argument of sort of the crypto community, in terms of the push for decentralization. And we look at various industries and say which industries would benefit from decentralization versus better centralization. And that's really a data problem, right? In many respects. So for example, if you look at the energy sector, and energy production needs at an economy level, the determination that we make is that, energy is better off being decentralized. Rooftop solar generation at a city level, residential batteries for storage of electricity, including the use of EVs as part of the grid level storage mechanism, and so forth, right? That the central generation mechanism is essentially failing around the world. We see that because of the Ukraine, Russia conflict at the moment and its impact on energy. Better decentralized distributed systems are required for energy production. But then if you look at healthcare is a perfect example of what you're talking about, is that the ability to reform healthcare and make healthcare work much more cost effectively for the community depends on very large data sets. And, in the instance of like the United States healthcare system, which is extremely inefficient, The privatized element of that, and the fact that you've got all of these different, oligopoly systems in healthcare, actually is going to produce a negative effect because of lack of access to data. So you really need to have sort of a national healthcare data set, which is around DNA, blood work, the gene therapy stuff, things like that. All of the modeling that you would require to make significant advances in improving, AI-based diagnostics, reducing administrative load, the effectiveness of gene models and all of those sorts of things requires better and better data sharing and better quality data to be able to tackle that. So the more that you have that tied up in private corporations that aren't sharing that data, the less effective a 21st century healthcare system could be. So there are a couple of examples of illustrations of how we really have to change our systemic thinking. When you start thinking about food production, again, there's a data element to this, but also it's a matter of thinking about, supply chain design. So, food scarcity is going to be a massive problem over the next 30 years, primarily because of climate change, sensitivity of crops to temperatures, but also, we saw during the pandemic how this issue of globalization versus localization and the supply chain impact under pressure could affect supply chain, affect those sort of things. So having vertical farms in urban centers, lab-grown proteins, factories producing lab-grown proteins and so forth, to reduce or to mitigate the risk of, problems with food scarcity and supply chain issues, they are all part of it. Not exactly a data problem, but it is a systems design problem that involves us looking at the data and thinking about more efficient ways of organizing.
Yeah. Obviously, we've touched on a few issues that could be coming up in the future. Are there any sort of particular technologies that you look to for reassurance that are sort of emerging at the moment that you think need to be focused on as we move forwards to face some of these problems?
Well, obviously I'm a fan of AI and its ability to solve problems for us. I am not blind to the challenges of data bias and so forth, as sort of we introduced it earlier in the conversation, but I do think AI has massive potential for solving many problems. Just even the process of rethinking the way our system should work under highly automated economies will force us to rethink many areas. For example, the legal and justice system. As you build AI into the legal system and you automate laws, we're having to take laws that are on the books today and codify them, or put them into that construct to work on an automated fashion. And that process of sort of legal review and so forth in itself, I think, will be fairly significant in terms of thinking about the way our laws work and so forth. As an example, gene therapy in the healthcare field, diseases like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, cystic fibrosis, sickle cell anemia, breast cancer and so forth. These are genetic conditions that we will, very shortly over the next 10 years or so, be able to just edit out of our genome like a bad software bug, And so that's a tremendously, powerful, set of technologies for improving the overall health of people and longevity. Better sensors that enable us to maintain our health in a better way rather than sort of jumping onto symptoms the way we do today, anticipating, conditions and sort of knowing you're going to get sick before you do. Those sort of data models built on AI and based on these better understanding of how our health works. There are a couple of examples, of course, autonomous vehicles, which will reduce road fatalities, and just even automation generally, AI generally. The one of the big things we focus on in techno-socialism is when you have highly automated societies, which by 2050 most economies will be, At that point, you know, you will not have to work to put food on the table, because that will be a core function of the smart economy. Now people who are committed to capitalist thinking, the religion of capitalism here, get quite offended at this, because they think in terms of the only way to distribute wealth is for people to work, and if you stop them working, the system's going to break down. You know, and that's really the point of AI. AI has always been built to, or designed to, eliminate humans from the workforce in many ways. So then the question is, what do you do for work if you don't have to work to put food on the table? And the answer to that question is, you know, with universal basic income and so forth, well, you could do whatever you want. And that's where life gets really interesting. The ability for us to pursue things that are really meaningful for humanity, things that we're passionate about, rather than things we have to do to put food on the table and a roof over our head.
So one thing with technology is it does lead on to economics, and that's where in my kind of journey, have ended up. So one thing really relevant today is the concept of growth versus recession. And we, like I said, in the capitalist society, we've got this drive to want to be growing 2% every year, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But our natural resources don't allow for that infinitum.
Right.
So what does this model do when we can talk about growth and recession? Does it worry about that? Does it worry about recession? Because we kind of view recession as a bad thing. But actually, when we talk about resource-wise and resource usage, it might not be such a bad thing if we have a different metric which to measure our economy.
Well, I think that's a big part of the questions we ask in the book, in techno-socialism. And the question is I think the question is misaligned with the needs of society, right? And that is that, it is growth at all costs the best outcome for human society? And because we measured GDP growth, trade surpluses, you know, unemployment figures, all of those things, but in a world where 1.6 billion people are displaced by climate change, as an example, which is at the upper limit of the estimates, right? Where food scarcity is a massive problem. Where at the same time you have massive unemployment because of artificial intelligence. Is growth really important in that scenario? And so the question is, what is the purpose of an economy? Is it to grow and produce returns for the market, or should the purpose of the economy be to produce a high level of high quality of life, across the board for all citizens? Because if you measure the output of the economy being a metric for the quality of life for your citizens, the United States, for example, would fall down on that metric. You know, the United States does not look after its citizens well, you know, from an education perspective, healthcare perspective, you know, growing inequality perspective, access to housing, all of those things. But from a growth perspective, you know, it's the biggest economy the world's ever seen. And so this is a really interesting way to sort of think about, you know, the purpose of economies in the 21st century. Then let's throw in some other elements. AI is going to produce incredible amounts of wealth. The problem is not going to be growth from a pure economics perspective in terms of wealth. It's going to be distribution of that wealth effectively. And, AI in itself, because it takes humans out of the workforce, the labor force, that's the only mechanism we have for distribution of wealth in today's system. Is you work and you get paid, and the more you make as a salary, the better off you are, right? And so if that's no longer available to you because we've removed your job because of automation, that's a real problem. And then if you get into the 2040s, where we have things like asteroid mining as an example. There's one asteroid called 16 Psyche in the asteroid belt that SpaceX and NASA are in the process of sending a probe to right now, a mission to. That one asteroid has $10 quintillion worth of raw materials, gold, silver, platinum, you know, so forth. This is 100,000 times current annual GDP in one asteroid. So if we could capture this asteroid and bring it back to the moon for mining, you know, those resources, for example, then the commodities markets overnight would become worthless, valueless, right? And so this concept of growth in the 21st century, which doesn't take into account these other elements, is just simply not going to work. So this is a philosophical shift, is what is the purpose of our economy as an engine for the growth of humanity? Is it to just grow in terms of wealth and assets and, you know, market performance, or is it to grow humanity as a species? You know, what is the economy doing to improve the quality of life and to improve the outcome for humanity as a species? And when you look at it like that, you realize that the current system of growth and the way we've looked at resource utilization has been responsible for climate change. It's been responsible for 10 million deaths a year due to air pollution because of our use of fossil fuels. It's, you know, it's been responsible for, yes, some advances in medical science and so forth, but, you know, we could have advanced those fields probably a lot greater if we weren't focused on growth and we were more focused on the advancement of the species, if you like. Big picture stuff.
Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of where we wanted to end, really, because when we talk about futurism and technology and technocratic type of stuff, people are assuming this is not relevant to them necessarily. But the stuff that we're starting to see within our economics already is shifting that consideration. And, you know, since 2008, which I'm sure is where some of your thinking, the model's been creaking for quite a while, hasn't it?
Exactly.
So it's not something new, this creaking of the existing model. It's the fact that we've got a bit of a tug. You've got those who want to cling on to it because they're benefiting from it, and you've got those who are trying to pull away from it to define something different. And during that period, maybe through the acceleration of technology and social media, we've kind of lost the political discord to be able to talk about these things.
Well, I think there is a bit of a generational shift there. I think the younger generation, they don't care about markets and capitalism and share prices and, you know, those sorts of things in the way that we were trained to be in the 80s and 90s, an example. So I do think it's a generational shift in terms of policy thinking and priorities. Mm.
Excellent. So what's we always like to end on this question, don't we, Alex? Is the what's happening with you in the future?
Well, you know, so I started this new podcast in April, The Futurists. It's we're getting already about 5,000 downloads a week off that. So for a new podcast, it's going extraordinarily well. And we're thinking of turning that into a conference series, really looking at the future, sort of a Davos of the future, strategizing on the next 20, 50, 100 years. And hopefully, out of that will come some content that we can turn into a TV series. So there's that. I'm also working on two new banking books. So one, a second edition of Branch Today Gone Tomorrow, and one called The Rise of the Challengers that looks at the rise of challenger or neobanks and mobile wallets around the world.
Awesome. Yeah, obviously we'll put links to all of the stuff you've discussed in the episode in the description. I have to say I've been listening to The Futurist. It's fantastic. I'm a dedicated subscriber already. But yeah, as always with these interviews, there's a million things we didn't cover. So hopefully we'll get a chance to talk to you again in the future and try and cover some more bits.
Cool. And sorry for the technical challenges, but we got there in the end.
That's all good. This is international podcasting.
They probably haven't noticed. They probably haven't even noticed, the audience.
Awesome.
Excellent. Alrighty. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us, Brett.
Thanks, guys.
So that's it for another episode of the Atlas Podcast. Thank you for joining me, Martin.
Thanks, Alex. We've gone through another, well, I wouldn't say another season. I mean, a season of summer and autumn and it's good to have been chatting about all the great things that have happened. And there's a lot more to keep going at, really. So
100%. Yeah, got some more interesting interviews lined up, more topics to discuss. We'll obviously be back, perhaps looking at more of that Gartner report next week, and yeah, whatever we turn up in the news. For more information on Atlas and the projects we're involved in, head over to weareatlas.com. And to keep up to date with us, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @ATS_Atlas and on LinkedIn at @ATS_Atlas.